In this episode of Pemba On Demand, unpacking the end of Chevron, what healthcare leaders need to know about administrative law, my guest is Zach Buck, JD. Zach is the Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Professor of Law at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Zach obtained his JD from the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School in 2009. While he was also completing a master's degree in bioethics and medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine. Dr. Buck is a prolific author, writing on a variety of healthcare law-related topics. He focuses significantly on fraud, waste, and abuse issues. I'm very excited to have him on the show, sharing with you important knowledge you need regarding the Chevron deference and administrative law as it impacts our practices in healthcare today. Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of different healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare, career development, and healthcare leadership. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional or legal advice. The views and opinions expressed by me, the host, or guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization we are affiliated with. Well, Zach, it's great to have you on the show tonight. I appreciate you taking the time to be my guest and to share some of your thoughts with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, I've really been looking forward to this. And of course, in researching the show, I've learned a lot about things that I knew nothing about. So it's been a good opportunity for me.
It's great. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So I wonder if we could start off tonight just by having you share with us, with my audience, some insights regarding health policy matrices that law is intended to address in the U.S.
Sure. So the main piece that I want to highlight here is to encourage the audience to think about the underlying policies that support the laws that we enforce in this country. And so a legal structure that's as broad and vast as laws that govern healthcare policy have to organize themselves with, in some measure, depending on what kind of values they're trying to protect. And so when we talk about health law, we start with a conversation about health policy and some of the values that the laws are meant to try to address. So the four matrices that you mentioned: access, cost, quality, and choice. And so when we're talking about healthcare laws, healthcare regulations, rules that affect healthcare providers, many of the rules can be categorized into those four societal values. Now, the challenge, I think, for at least for American healthcare is we have a lot of unique challenges and concerns as they relate to those four matrices. So the American system, as we all know, is hampered by, in many cases, a lack of access, not just insurance access, but also access to high quality healthcare, not just for people who lack insurance altogether, but who are underinsured. And then even for people who do have insurance, those often have trouble with deductible costs or the cost of care that they've received. So a lot of legal interventions focus on how can we improve access for people who are trying to get the healthcare that they need, preventive or otherwise. And so you can put the a law like the Affordable Care Act, which has been on the books now for 15 years, into that kind of matrix to see whether or not the law actually achieves some of the societal values and goals that we have regarding access. Cost, of course, as I mentioned, is another one. So cost focuses on what can law do to try to make the exchange of healthcare more efficient for patients? How can they get a better deal on their care? And as we know, American healthcare is hampered, of course, by a lack of cost control on many goods and services. And so there are ways that the law intervenes to try to address this, to try to allow different payers to negotiate. We can talk about insurance regulations in this space, but there are challenges not just broadly across different systems that we look at across the United States, outside of the United States. We compare the cost of different healthcare services to other countries, and we see vast differences. But we also even see individual differences among patients within the same hospital, that one patient may pay a whole lot more for a service than another based on their insurance status or or even, you know, what kind of plan they have. So cost becomes a major challenge as it relates to legal intervention. And it often relates, of course, to access. So if you're unable to bring down the cost of care, then you're also impacting access. The third matrix that we talk about in health law and policy is quality. And so a big chunk of the courses I teach at the law school focus on how can the law be deployed to improve healthcare quality in the United States, whether that be what we call private law through the tort system, following an injury to try to change some of the incentives going forward, or public law. How can we bring government entities and agencies to bear to try to improve the quality of healthcare across the country? Of course, the differences between those two fields of law focus on what we call ex post intervention. So following a harm, we might rely on a tort system where a patient has gotten harmed and they're trying to seek a remedy. Whereas in the regulatory space or the public law space, we're intervening in an ex ante manner. We're trying to intervene before harm occurs by requiring doctors to have a medical license, for instance, or requiring drugs to be approved by the FDA. There are all sorts of interventions that the law seeks in this space to try to protect patient care. And then the final matrix that we talk about is choice. This is kind of a new one. I think 10 or 15 years ago, if you were in a health law class, choice wasn't one of the kind of four values that we talked about. But it has become important as we have continued to have intervention focused on empowering consumers in this space. Are there ways that we can bring transparency to bear? Are there price transparency interventions? You read about this in different state Medicaid programs or insurance plans. And so this is another place where we look at legal intervention to try to improve the patient experience within healthcare.
Okay, great. Thanks for that introduction, Zach. I had one question as you were talking. As you look at what's going on in healthcare law circles right now, is there one of these matrices that seems to be consuming, maybe capturing more interest or is being focused on more currently?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say they ebb and flow. And if we're talking, I guess, about specifically about legal intervention, there's been a lot of focus, at least in the last decade and a half, on access. Redoubled effort to try to deploy law to improve patient access, whether that be increasing the amount of people who are insured through the Affordable Care Act exchanges or through Medicaid expansion, or to try to encourage the expansion of healthcare services in certain parts of the country. So access has been a big kind of focus over the last decade and a half. Quality is quite constant, at least from my perspective, that we've seen a big change, at least in enforcement or focus or legal intervention. I mean, the big one that remains, I think, that is kind of the bear in the room is cost. We don't have a lot of legal interventions that are good at bringing down the cost of care. And that's largely because we're just kind of uncomfortable with regulating any kind of good, particularly from a cost control perspective. You know, we deploy negotiation and different kind of payer techniques, but the law is not great at imposing cost caps, for instance, in any part of the economy. And so that's an area where there's not been a lot of focus, at least since I've been in the field.
Okay, thank you. I wonder if you could spend a little bit of time, too, sharing some information regarding the various sources of power that come into play with the law and from the government as it relates to us, healthcare providers, deliverers of care. We almost all nowadays work for healthcare organizations, and there's a huge focus on regulatory issues. And we've seen, I guess, just in the past 6 to 8 weeks, the battle going on now between who has the power to make changes and how quickly can they make changes. So I thought it would be interesting to get your insights on that a little bit as well.
So when we talk in the law school about sources of power, I think one of the major themes that we like to highlight is that sources of power within the government, outside of the government, within an agency, they are fragmented and they are often parallel or overlapping in some spaces. There may be state control in certain aspects of medical practice, federal control, courts, regulatory agencies, Congress, state legislatures, it goes on and on. So I think the best way to think about it as it relates to healthcare is to think both about the federal level and the state level. It's important, I think, to start at the state level to think about states still retain the, for the most part, primary authority to regulate the practice of medicine. And so if you think about your medical licensure, that is governed by state law. The federal government is empowered to, of course, through its major program of Medicare and its collaborative program of Medicaid with the states, to use those plans or those programs to inject regulatory oversight over hospitals, doctors, clinics, et cetera. And so the federal government also has a role to play here too, but it's not as direct as the state has. The state has a public health authority by virtue of being a state to ensure the health of the populace. And so the federal government has the kind of fragmented power in this space. And then on top of that, you could look at kind of the, not just the depth of power, but you could look at the breadth of power across different federal players. So when we talk about law school, we're talking about, you know, the legislative power, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. And all three of those co-equal branches of government have some input over what our healthcare system looks like. What is interesting in the healthcare space is that, of course, Congress is the entity that legislates and passes the laws, but we also have a very robust executive power in the agencies, Health and Human Services, of course, FDA, CDC, all these entities, word salad that we talk about, have a lot of power to enforce the law. And on top of that, they have a lot of regulatory interpretation power as well. So if Congress passes a law that is unclear, the agency that's tasked with enforcing it will often also interpret what that law means in a given context. And so when you're talking about sources of power, you understand not just typical congressional power and, of course, executive power, and then, of course, court oversight, but also you have to understand how agencies work, which is what we call administrative law in the law school. What governs agency interpretation? When do agencies go too far? How much power should they be given? When do they potentially contradict what Congress wants? All those things are at stake when we're talking about sources of power within the government.
Okay. So it's a very complex playing field with states and federal, and then even within the federal government, there's very many different sources of power. There's been conversations about single source payer for years, right? National Health Service Corps type of system. How would that change the impact between the authority and the power that the states have now versus the federal government?
It's a great question. And part of our federalist-based society and our structure creates a lot of roadblocks for a nationalized healthcare system, which is why you see, at least not so much anymore, but in the middle of the last decade, you'd see a lot of states that were examining these kind of efforts, maybe a state universal healthcare plan or insurance plan. The federal government, of course, something like this would be much larger and also would encounter a whole lot of constitutional law challenges, largely because states have the authority to do this. What's interesting, though, is that the federal government wouldn't necessarily be using any kind of innate power that it had, but it would be using its negotiating leverage to basically force entities or providers to kind of come to heel if a universal health plan would be created. So for instance, in the Medicare system and the Medicare program as it currently exists, there's no mandate. There's no legal mandate for any provider or any hospital to treat anyone who's on Medicare. There's no requirement. The federal government can't do it. They can't require providers to see patients who are on Medicare. But what they can do is make the deal so good that providers can't say no, or make the population so large and so potentially lucrative for hospitals, right, that they can't say. And so something like that would likely be present if we used Medicare as the kind of model and just expanded it out. That's probably what likely would happen, but it would be a system that would probably still be voluntary, but it would be based on something that would be a quote unquote good deal for the providers.
Interesting. I guess I had never realized the barriers involved federalism versus state rights. I hadn't really made that connection before. So thank you for explaining that to me.
Sure.
I wonder, the topic of our talk tonight is really unpacking Chevron and kind of understanding how that's going to impact, or the ways that it could potentially impact healthcare. So I wonder if we can pivot a little bit, and I'd like to ask you a few questions about that and kind of take us down that road and help us understand. If most physicians are like me, I would have to say that I really didn't have a high level of awareness about this decision, but the more I looked into it, the more interesting I found it to be. I think people will be really interested in kind of getting your perspective on this as well. There's been some recent Supreme Court decisions, cases that signal a shift away from what's called the Chevron deference. And I wonder if you could, number one, explain a little bit about what Chevron deference is and then how this shift could impact the regulatory landscape for us in healthcare.
Sure. I'm glad you found it interesting. This is the point where I usually lose my lawsuit. So we have room in the law school if you'd like to come join us. So Chevron's really important in healthcare because it kind of ameliorated the potential concern when you have a disagreement between what I mentioned prior, which was between the legislature and the agency. So as I mentioned, Congress will pass laws. These laws will govern all sorts of different healthcare aspects. The agencies that are within the executive branch will be tasked with enforcing or implementing the laws that Congress passes. In that implementation process, there are a myriad of questions that are unanswerable from Congress that either Congress didn't speak to in the legislation or didn't think to speak to. There may be something that Congress didn't even think that a conflict would arise and there'd be some complication related to the implementation of the law. And so the agency has to, in the moment, figure out how do we deal with this hole, basically. And the Chevron doctrine, which stands for a Supreme Court case that had been on the books for 40 years, basically told agencies to interpret what they thought was appropriate under their power. And that a court would review what the agency did with deference, meaning that the court would trust, as long as it was reasonable, whatever the agency determined was the right answer, given the question to some piece of legislation. So in practice, courts were tasked with basically determining whether a law at issue was ambiguous. If it was ambiguous, then they would allow the agency to determine what that law meant in a given context, as long as that interpretation was reasonable. So that doctrine was, in some ways, I mean, literally deferential to the agency to determine what was appropriate. And the reason for that, according to the court at the time, Supreme Court, was that these agencies are tasked, or sorry, are led by a number of experts in the field. You know, FDA is led by individuals who have expertise in the space, CMS, right? And so the idea was if we empower the experts to determine kind of what's appropriate, that that would be good for everybody, that it would allow the agency to kind of fill in gaps that Congress left in ways that made sense, given what the agency knows and given what they're able to do. So that was the Chevron doctrine that was on the books since the mid-1980s. What we've seen in the last Supreme Court term was an overturning of the Chevron doctrine by a case known as the Loper-Bright case. And in that case, the court basically said, we're not going to give agencies that kind of deference anymore. We're going to review what agencies do with a kind of bigger club in our bag, and we're going to be less deferential to agency power in this space. And so what that has done, we don't know yet exactly what it will do, but it has at least opened the door to the potential that courts are now going to be more empowered to determine what a particular piece of legislation means and direct that meaning to the agency, as opposed to letting the agency take the lead and having a court basically bless whatever the agency did. So as it relates to healthcare, you have the potential for, depending on which courts are answering which questions at which times, you might have jurisdictional splits. You might have uncertain applications of certain rules or regulatory functions. And so that opens the door at least to some uncertainty and turbulence in the regulatory space that maybe Chevron would not have countenanced. The issue, of course, with Chevron was agencies are also not static. They move quickly too. They change administration to administration. And so sometimes you would also have turbulence in that world as well. At this point, we're kind of talking about what might happen. We don't necessarily know exactly what will be, but there is the potential that at least as it relates to healthcare law, courts will now be more empowered to say, basically determine what Congress has done, and agencies may have lost some of their power in this space.
It sounds like it's pretty early to tell what the overall final impact will be, but from what you said, in theory at least, they're eliminating the deference to the experts, the people who really understand, like at the FDA or the CDC or any of the other agencies, HHS, and having judges make a decision about what the lawmakers intended when they passed the law.
Yeah, I think that's a likely outcome. I do think, though, that if you had the Supreme Court in this podcast, I think they would say that Congress is the legitimate authority, lawmaking authority, because it is tied to our democratic values. And when Congress doesn't speak to something, they're not telling agencies to fill in the gaps. They're just not speaking to that. And I think the courts would say it's not in the agency's role to fill in these gaps that exist in law. Now, I think there's some power to that argument. I think in reality, you know, Congress, it can be messy. Legislation can be messy, and interventions can be well-intentioned and not work out the way they thought, or not answer the question they thought they were answering, or whatever it may be. And so I do think on the whole, this probably has the effect of, has kind of a deregulatory effect. If you're telling agencies you can't really do what you thought you could do, but it could be the case that that courts, depending on, you know, which court hears these types of challenges, may think that, you know, whatever the agency thought was appropriate is exactly what Congress intended. So it is still early days in this space, but you're right. I think it does move the needle, at least. And related to this, too, there have been some other kind of doctrines deployed in Supreme Court cases, a couple others that we've noticed, at least those of us that follow in the healthcare space. One was the major questions doctrine that the court has looked at, which is this kind of idea that if Congress doesn't speak to something, that the agency can't just fill in the answer, that anything that's related to the inner workings of a law that's a major question, Congress is the entity that has to speak to it. So that, coupled with the overturn of Chevron, suggests that we're kind of moving back toward a stronger kind of legislative and court piece, and we're actually taking power away from the executive branch in these agencies.
But the court would say that these are powers that the executive branch never should have wielded in the first place, according to our Constitution.
That's exactly right. They would say that, yes, that this is something that fits within the realm of legislative authority and that the agency should not take it. What's interesting, of course, is it's also empowering courts, right? The very decision maker who's deciding this is also saying, well, we're the ones that can tell you when these types of laws are doing what we think they're supposed to be doing, as opposed to agencies. So a lot of administrative law scholars will cast this as courts versus agencies in this case. Yeah.
So are there any early decisions that have been a result of this decision, of the change in this deference to the agencies, that are already beginning to have impacts on healthcare providers or payers, various regulatory agencies like CMS or HHS?
Not anything that has been notable, at least, that we think would be lasting. I mean, there's been court cases that you read about that are percolating through the district courts as they relate to powers of the administrative agencies, but nothing that, at least at this point, we know is clearly coming. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the next term or two, we have examples that we can point to. And they may not be in the healthcare space. That's the other kind of complicated, you know, the EPA is often mentioned in some of these major questions doctrine cases. Other, you know, labor organizations, regulatory board for the Department of Labor, for instance. So there's different examples where you see this. There was a challenge related to healthcare specifically as it related to COVID vaccinations, and that Medicare had required hospitals to vaccinate their healthcare providers if Medicare beneficiaries were visiting those hospitals. Those were challenged under Biden administration rules. Those were upheld. But there was a lot of discussion among the Supreme Court justices in that case. It was Biden versus Missouri, about whether or not CMS or Medicare had the authority to order vaccination, which is also kind of an interesting question. Like, Medicare was not created to order private citizens to be vaccinated. And so justices kind of grappled with that question as well. So that's an example of where you see it kind of coming out, but we're still early days, like I mentioned.
So do you have any sense of how And maybe as you talk to attorneys for healthcare organizations or payers or even agency attorneys, what kind of uncertainty is this causing in the industry right now?
Yeah, I think the best advice that I could give healthcare providers is to, you know, stay the course as it exists currently. And that is because many of these regulations, they're not immediately in jeopardy because Chevron has been overturned. It just means that for future adversarial proceedings, the court may determine a different way forward. And so if and when that happens, you have to be flexible and ready to, you know, change the way that maybe you've thought that, you know, a CMS regulation or FDA policy might have governed the way that you practice or something that you do. But it's not an overnight light switch. It's what we would call a rule of review that has changed, meaning mm-hmm. that, of course, you still have to wait court challenge and then years probably of litigation, which is always the answer that I give to physicians who don't like to hear. It depends answer, right? Which we say a lot here in the law school. So you do just have to kind of, I think the smartest thing is not to overreact. You're just kind of waiting to see what is challenged. But I do think that being ready for changes is smart.
Right. I'm sure there are both potential benefits and drawbacks. What are some of the main potential benefits to us as healthcare providers? And what are some of the biggest potential drawbacks that we might see as healthcare providers because of this change?
Yeah, I think that the potential upside involves, I mean, if you're thinking about kind of the Schoolhouse Rock view of how a bill becomes a law and how the government is intended to work, I think the upside to something like this would be, well, you as the physician who has expertise and authority and some cultural power, as patients look to you for what kind of the future of healthcare should be, you have the ability to influence congressional policy in some way. And if we're living in a world in which the agency has lost some power and Congress has more power to determine what the law is, then that provides an opening for all citizens to petition and make their voices heard and to push their representatives to improve healthcare through the legislative process. We know that's messy. We know it takes a long time, years and years and years for the, you know, Medicare and Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act and on and on and on. But that doesn't mean it's not worth it. And so I think the upside would be a real focus on kind of channeling your energies and your collective voice to thinking about how you can improve healthcare going forward. The downside, I'd say, is probably uncertainty. And like I mentioned, maybe some conflicting court decisions about certain Medicare regs or different CMS policies. And that's not great for business if there's uncertainty. If you don't really know whether the agency that's told you they're going to be enforcing the rule in this way, whether that's actually going to stand or not, that can get pretty complicated. So I think that the downside, at least now, if you're thinking about preparing yourself, you have to be kind of ready for that uncertainty. But it still remains to be seen how this ultimately plays out, for sure.
And do you think this is going to have an impact in the enforcement of regulations? Especially the regulations related to federal agencies like Medicare, the Affordable Care Act, that kind of thing?
You know, that's a really good question, because a lot of the enforcement mechanism depends upon resource allocation. And so that may be a separate question. My area of expertise where I practiced law was in healthcare fraud and abuse. So, you know, whether or not the False Claims Act or the anti-kickback statute prohibits some kind of conduct doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be enforcement around that particular area of violation. It may depend upon what the assistant U.S. attorney in the jurisdiction in which you live prioritizes, or how many healthcare fraud attorneys they've hired, or what kind of relators have run to the courthouse, or whatever it may be. There are so many other questions that influence those types of enforcement decisions. And so I don't know, you know, that's why when you're thinking about Chevron, you're really focused on very kind of technical, ethereal theory kind of questions. You know, what is the point of the agency? Who do we want deciding these questions? Is it appropriate for a kind of bureaucratic agency, unelected, to be determining what the meaning of a law is, right? And those are really separate questions from what an AUSA in a given jurisdiction, assistant U.S. attorney in a given jurisdiction, is going to prioritize, whether it's nursing home enforcement or hospital enforcement or whatever it may be? That's a great question.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So the balance of power is really foundational for our government. And, you know, this delicate balance between the judicial branch, the executive branch, and legislative branch, obviously. So would you characterize this as a seismic change in the balance of power? Would you say that it is a little ripple on the surface of a calm pond? How do you see this playing out 10, 15 years down the road as you look back at this? What do you think the impact will have been?
Well, I'll be able to go back and watch this video and know if I was right, right? which is always a horrifying prospect. I think at this point, I think that at least for healthcare providers, I don't think we're talking about a seismic move, but it doesn't mean that that potential doesn't exist. There have been a lot of changes, as you can attest, in healthcare delivery over the years that could be related to legal intervention in some way. We could talk about that. And, you know, the fact that courts had input, that the legislature had input, there was uncertainty, and that was under the Chevron doctrine. That was under the doctrine that gave deference to agencies, and courts were still busy. And so, I don't know. I think courts will continue to be busy. I think that agencies will continue to be busy. Agencies will, I do think it's important to highlight, just because we're changing the rule of review here doesn't mean that agencies automatically lose, right? There may be cases where the court is like, yeah, I guess the agency is well within its authority here. But we don't know when those situations will occur and when they won't. And that's part of the uncertainty. We don't really know when courts will look at these agency decisions and think that they're well within their wheelhouse of why the agency was initially created and when they're not. So I think that it's always important to kind of take a breath and think about how the world will actually change for healthcare providers in this space. And I, at least at this moment, I don't foresee a whole lot based solely on Chevron or the overturn of Chevron, but the potential is there for sure.
Well, some constitutional scholars talk, they use the term judicial activism to kind of talk about how the court systems have on their own usurped authority from both the legislative branch and the executive branch. Do you see that as a risk given the change in the interpretation of the Chevron doctrine?
Another great question. I had a constitutional law professor in law school who said that judicial activism is what people say when they're upset with the court. And I think it is in some ways very healthy for the branches to be criticizing each other and saying that they're grabbing power that they shouldn't be grabbing, because that's what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be holding each other in check. You know, if the Congress says agencies have gotten out of control, like, okay, that might be part of the balance of power that our forefathers created. When courts say that Congress is out of line and strikes down something that Congress did, that might not be a bad thing. And when the president hammers a court, again, it may not be a bad thing in every instance. So it's hard to know, right? It's a value-laden judgment. It depends on kind of where you sit, where you think the court's role should be, where you think the other players should, what they should be doing. I do think the court is the authority on interpretation of these kinds of doctrines. I guess I get troubled as it relates to your question when the court changes track pretty dramatically because of just the kind of priors and the kind of notice for private citizens who, you know, may not have anticipated that the court would strike out in a different way on a different path. So that's what I kind of pay attention to, but I don't really focus too much on, you know, whether this overturning of Chevron means that, you know, the court is out of line or not. It may be the case that the court always surprises you in some ways. You know, you think they're going in one direction, they don't, they back off, they become you know, less aggressive in another space. So it's hard to predict. But I do think it's worth saying it's not just all total fog. I mean, I do think it's worth saying that, yes, this decision did make, it made a clear statement about what the court thought had been something that has, that had gotten kind of out of balance as it related to interpretation power. And so I think that's worth saying, whether that means that, you know, the court's out of line or not, or, you know, that I leave that to other people to debate. But I do think that we have a tendency at least to overreact too. So it's worth watching the long term of this, maybe even watching this Supreme Court term currently, especially the summer, to see some of the decisions coming out in June, to see whether, you know, the trend continues in this space.
Thanks for taking the time to explain that. And I will put a reminder in my calendar for 10 years from now to send you a link to this video so we can both watch it again and see.
Thank you for doing that. I tell my students I don't predict the future because, I mean,
yeah,
of all the times the Affordable Care Act was under Supreme Court review and I thought, this is it, it's going away, right? How many times could you be wrong in a 10-year period? I don't know. So, thank you.
So I thought maybe we'd shift a little bit. You mentioned earlier that you've really kind of specialized in fraud and abuse, and I know you've written extensively about False Claim Act. Could you explain to us how the False Claim Act is used to combat fraud and abuse specifically within healthcare?
Sure. So, man, where do I start? The False Claims Act is one of the oldest statutes on the books. It actually was known as Lincoln's Law. It's been around since the Civil War. And understanding that history is really important, understanding how it works in modern America. What it did is kind of a bizarre law when it was passed. It basically was geared toward trying to prevent the Union Army from being sold defective armaments by people who were basically ripping off the federal government and the Union Army. And so it created these kind of interesting provisions that allowed the federal government to be kind of represented or deputize a private citizen, who we call a relator, file a lawsuit on behalf of the government. And we call those QUTAM provisions, if you've seen those before, Q-U-I space T-A-M.
Yes.
So a Latin phrase that refers to on behalf of the king. So the idea is, because the federal government didn't know who in the field was selling these defective armaments, but if we could empower people who were on the ground who were actually buying these things and finding out they didn't work and allowing them to sue on our behalf, deputizing them on behalf of the federal government, and that would be much more effective at ferreting out the fraud. So fast forward 162 years, and you have a law that, since modern amendments in 1986, has got much more powerful and has been used as the primary tool against healthcare providers and entities who have allegedly committed fraud. So what it does is it basically makes illegal any false claim or false statement that is sent to the federal government for payment or approval, or any kind of statement connected to those payments. And so anytime you bill Medicare or Medicaid, you are exposing yourself potentially to False Claims Act liability if you've gotten something wrong on the medical bill, or if you've lied about something, some aspect of care, maybe you've billed something that you didn't do, that's a false claim. And this also applies beyond healthcare. It applies to any, you know, federal loan application or tax return as well. So as it relates to the healthcare space, what providers have to really worry about is particularly intent and falsity. Those are kind of the two big requirements for the statute. And so intent requires that the doctor act with at least reckless disregard of whether the bill that they were submitting was true or false. And courts, there's a lot of movement in that standard. That doesn't mean you have to intentionally lie. It doesn't mean you have to know that you're lying. All it requires is that you have to be reckless. Right. So if you're not checking your bills, or you're billing for 25 hours a day by mistake, courts have said that's recklessness. So it's not negligence, but it's something a little bit more than negligence is required. And then the other piece, which I spend a lot of my time thinking about and writing about, is falsity. So what does it mean to submit a false claim? Well, the easy cases are the ones where no care has been provided at all, and someone is submitting a claim. That is a very easy slam dunk case, not just because it's a false claim, but it's also intentional. You have intent and falsity. The really hard cases are the cases where the provider submits a bill thinking that they're not submitting a false claim. And I'll give you an example here. So when you submit a form, CMS 1500 form, to get reimbursement using your prescriber number, provider number to Medicare, you sign a statement that says all care provided herein is reasonable and necessary. And believe it's reasonable and necessary. But what if the government thinks that it wasn't necessary? What if the government thinks that you were engaged in overtreatment, or that you administered a CT scan that wasn't actually clinically indicated, or you placed a stent in a chest of a patient whose arteries weren't quite sufficiently occluded? That's where the cases get really complicated and where physicians get really nervous, and where I think the theory of the False Claims Act kind of crashes into the reality of modern American medicine, because law itself is blunt. It's meant to be standardized. It's not great at ferreting out granular details. Medicine is individualized. It's not blunt. And so you're applying a legal standard to the practice of medicine, and you run into all sorts of challenges. So that's kind of the general gist of how a law like the False Claims Act could apply to the practice of American medicine. And the last thing I'll say is the reason why you should care is because the False Claims Act has some of the most draconian monetary penalties associated with of any law in the federal government's arsenal. And so there, you're not only charged a per claim penalty, which is statutory, which is now it keeps bumping around, but somewhere around $13,000 to $25,000 per claim, and then a treble damages amount, which is however much the entity is harmed by whatever it was that was billed for, you triple that. So part of the challenge here for providers is if you get a notice that you're being investigated for an FCA action, it is often not a good bet to try to fight that to trial. And so that's why you get a ton of settlement made law in this space, because providers don't want to risk their whole careers on these types of investigations. So that's the False Claims Act in a nutshell, if that's not scary enough for all your doctors.
Well, there's something I learned tonight that I didn't think I was going to learn. I've always thought there was only one thing in healthcare that was a holdover from the Civil War time, and that was the fax machine. But now I know that the fraud and abuse statutes are from that same time period. So there's two things that are plaguing us from that same era.
Who would think that a Civil War statute wouldn't be a great fit for Medicare billing?
Exactly. What about Stark Law and anti-kickback? Are they outgrowths or evolutions of the False Claim Act, or did they come into healthcare through an entirely different way and to prevent something entirely different than false claims?
Yes, the latter. So they're from different sources. The anti-kickback statute is actually part of the what we call the Social Security amendments that kind of led to the creation of the Medicare program. So the anti-kickback statute prevents, so where the False Claims Act is between a provider or entity and the government, an anti-kickback statute is often between two private parties, where one party is sending money to some kind of money, whether it's a discount or a bonus, to another party, and that second party is sending patients to that first party. So you're basically trading patients or referrals for dollars or something of value. The anti-kickback statute is newer, of course, than the False Claims Act. It's been on the books kind of in the modern era for about, 30 to 40 years. And it has different requirements. It requires a criminal standard. The False Claims Act is a civil statute. So when we say that in law, we mean beyond a reasonable doubt for an anti-kickback violation. So a defendant has more protection in a case like that. But the anti-kickback statute is a criminal statute. So it carries with it a criminal penalty. And so it's a more serious issue. So in those cases, the anti-kickback statute can be just as alarming as the False Claims Act. The one thing I'll say that's interesting about the anti-kickback statute is that there are a number of safe harbors. So if the podcast audience is wondering, isn't every deal in healthcare money for something, money for patients, money for some kind of innovative healthcare service, perhaps? I would say yes. So any kind of deal puts you kind of within the ambit of potentially any kickback violation. But there are more than three dozen safe harbors, including employment or independent contracting or discounts. Literally, there's one called discounts. And so your general counsel or your attorney is required to ensure that when you sign a contract or you're getting paid by a hospital or whatever it is, that you're complying with a safe harbor, which might require, you know, your contract be in writing, your services be specified, you're paid for fair market value, they're not overpaying you for a stream of patients, for instance. So all of that is totally normal and is something to think about. Yeah, whether you're within the safe harbor or the anti-kickback statute. The final one you asked about was the Stark Law. The Stark Law has been on the books now for about 30 years. It's a model of the Florida law. There was a Florida law that preceded it. And what Stark does is it prevents any physician from referring patients to entities in which that physician has a financial interest. So if you own a lab company, you can't refer your patients to your lab company. The patient may choose to go to your lab company to get services that they need, but you can't tell them to go to the lab company. Interestingly, the Stark Law does not apply to anyone but physicians. It requires only physicians are covered by Stark. It also only applies to what we call designated health services. So there are some wide swaths of healthcare that are not within the ambit of the Stark Law, but the Stark Law has no intent standard. So it doesn't ask whether you thought you were violating the law or you made a mistake or it was an accident or whatever it was, whether the patient got a referral from you to go to the clinic in which you had a financial interest, then that's all is needed for you to violate Stark. But just like the anti-kickback statute, there are safe harbors as well. So your again, general counsel, to the extent you have an ownership interest in a clinic or a lab service or a physical therapy entity, or even someone in your family has some kind of entity that you could have a financial relationship with, your general counsel or attorney will want to make sure that you're within a safe harbor or what we call an exception in Stark Law as well. There's a lot of overlap between Stark and anti-kickback, but those are things you want to think about. Again, those harms are different though. Anti-kickback is the concern is overutilization and steering patients and unfair competition. Stark, the same. You're just trying to benefit yourself and you might lead a patient down a road that they go for a service that they don't need. False Claims Act is different, right? It's the federal government that's being ripped off, taxpayers that are being ripped off. So they do address different harms, even though they all kind of apply often together in a given fraud investigation.
So of these three, which would you say is the most likely to impact of a well-meaning physician who's just trying to do what's best for the patients? Let's just assume there's no nefarious intent in any of their activities, and certainly they're not trying to rip anybody off or do anything that would be considered illegal. Which of these three statutes would be the most likely to impact someone like that?
I think a lot of physicians are afraid of Stark just because there's not a lot of backstop for the well-meaning physician who just didn't understand the reach of the statute. Because there is no intent standard, and it is not a criminal law standard. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just what we call preponderance of the evidence. And so that means in law that the prosecution or the federal government has to prove like 50% plus one in order to find you liable. So I think that the Stark Law is probably the one that most physicians are the most concerned about. The anti-kickback statute, we're talking about criminal behavior. And when I've talked to federal prosecutors, they say they only usually pull out those criminal statutes when there's clear patient harm. The patients are being clearly harmed by something that the physician is doing. The problem, of course, with Stark is that if you violate Stark and then because of the, you know, let's say you have a lab that you're referring patients to and one of those patients is on Medicare, well, now you're billing Medicare for services that are violating Stark, that opens you up for false claims liability, right? Because the federal government is like, wait a minute, you're billing us for something that you're basing on a violation of another violation of law. So you just have to be ultra careful about making sure that you've got legal advice at every turn, that you've got an attorney who knows what they're doing on all these things. Like, that's what I always say. When I'm teaching doctors, you know, make sure in your jurisdiction you've got a lawyer that you can trust with your institution, and make sure that they know what they're doing. Because a lot of this stuff actually sounds scary, but it can be complied with through some very simple steps. You know, that you have to follow these safe harbors, you have to follow the exceptions, But it ends up being a matter of simple compliance in a lot of these spaces.
And just as another question, are employed physicians less vulnerable than independent physicians?
At least on a fraud and abuse perspective, yes. Because we think that if you're employed, the entity is directing and controlling more of what you're doing. And in that scenario, whether it's right or wrong, you can look into the safe harbors to see that there is a kind of preference from the policymakers that you're employed, because that gives you a little bit more protection in these safe harbors. If you look at it, there's not a huge amount of light between the two, though, just because the dominant model for so long, as you know, for physicians was independent contracting. So as more physicians have moved into employment relationships with entities, I think they're able to take a deep breath a little bit easier at night in those instances, but it's not a huge paradigm change, but there are a few things that make it better to be an employed physician than an independent contractor. Again, if you have a good lawyer, they'll know the differences and you make sure that whatever your arrangement is, you're covered.
Okay. Yeah. So pharmaceutical companies have been coming under a lot of scrutiny. I don't know if I'm just noticing it more or if it's actually, but certainly it's been a focus for many, many years. 340B is a program right now that is getting a lot of discussion. I recently was part of an advocacy day where we were talking about the benefits of 340B for the federally qualified health centers that I work for, and both hospitals and FQHCs benefit differently, but similarly, I guess, to those. But I noticed that some of your writings have focused on pharmaceutical issues and legal and ethical concerns regarding pricing, off-label marketing, and that kind of thing. What are some of those concerns, and how do you see those changing over the next 4 to 8 years?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think from a pharmaceutical perspective, so my experience typically focuses on the fraud overlay with pharmaceutical pricing or pharmaceutical marketing, as opposed to, you know, scientific expertise for, you know, regulatory oversight or clinical trial regulation. I do a little bit of that, but most of my writing has been on both the regulation of marketing of pharmaceutical drugs and the regulation of pricing of pharmaceutical drugs. There's not a whole lot of law in the pharmaceutical pricing context, aside from some of the allegedly fraudulent schemes that the federal government has brought. And that relates largely to alleging that pharmaceutical companies were inflating certain best price rules and ripping off state Medicaid agencies if they weren't giving Medicaid the right prices based on how much they were charging other buyers. And then there's some a little bit around specialty pharmacies and PBMs. I've done a little bit on that as well. But I think the probably most salient example for doctors is where regulation meets marketing. So can a prescription or can a pharmaceutical drug marketing sales representative talk about an off-label use to you if you're a doctor asking a question? Can they trumpet some scientific study that shows that their drug is effective in some other manner that has not been FDA approved? So there's been a lot of turbulence in that space as it relates to both marketing rules, fraud rules around the what we call the FDCA, Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which gives rise to the FDA, and the First Amendment, interestingly. So arguments from the sales representatives that they have a First Amendment right to share information that they know about safety and efficacy of drugs, even if it's not been vetted by the FDA. And this is something that's kind of changed actually since I've even been in practice. When I was in legal practice, there were very tight strictures around what sales reps could and could not say and do and could not do as it related to off-label uses for pharmaceutical drugs. There was a seminal case about a decade ago that threw out a conviction for a sales rep who was marketing or talking about a drug and sharing information with physicians related to information that had not been FDA approved. And that was thrown out under First Amendment principles by a court of appeals. And since that moment, it's kind of both sides have kind of frozen. The FDA doesn't want anything else to happen. And the marketing sales reps don't really want to challenge, again, basically that ruling. So nowadays, there's a lot of kind of complicated academic debate around what is appropriate in this space. And the standard now, at least in that case, was truthful, scientifically non-misleading information is protected. Again, if it's not FDA approved, kind of wondering, well, what does that actually mean, right? And physicians with expertise could tell me exactly what that looks like. But that's where we are now. So that's a space that I will continue to watch. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of development in these spaces over the next few years. A lot of these spaces are defined by major court cases and enterprising attorneys. And there's much more determined by the kind of conflict that we see bubbling up from, you know, any, you know, like I mentioned, the conviction of one man for off-label marketing than any kind of government push, at least in this space. So that's partly why I find it so fascinating, is that it can, you know, one potential case can really change the regulatory trajectory.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for going into that. I find it fascinating as I've gotten more involved in the dialogue around pharmaceuticals in the past 5 years. I think it's an interesting area to keep an eye on. And there's a lot of conversations just about pharmacy benefit managers right now and whether they are a value add for us or whether they just divert dollars into unnecessary pockets, I guess would be the best way to say that.
Yeah, for sure.
I've also been impressed by the rise in the frequency of telehealth and digital health technologies. Especially in the COVID pandemic, we really came to rely on them heavily. How do you see that impacting fraud and abuse risks, fraud or abuse risks for healthcare providers?
Sure. I hesitate again to predict the future, but I think that major concerns around telehealth that were present during the COVID-19 pandemic related largely to, like you mentioned, fraud and abuse for billing, and then also privacy concerns. And in some ways, as is often the case, the reality of that crisis forced us into a world that we weren't totally ready for. If you were someone who studies healthcare privacy or is worried about healthcare fraud and abuse, of course, that kind of care is great. Like going back to our conversation at the beginning of this talk, as it relates to access, the idea that individuals can access care in a way that they never would have been able to, of course, is really important and cannot be ignored. The concern, of course, is, are those conversations between you and your provider over Zoom protected sufficiently by HIPAA standards? Is there someone in the other room in your home who's listening to what you're saying? You're not in a doctor's office. Is the doctor billing for the care that they should be billing for, i.e., is the care that you're getting of a sufficient quality that we should be paying for it on the same level that we were paying for an in-person visit, right? And yeah. So I think all those questions are really hard to answer, especially in a world in which you think you don't have another option. So I actually, there was a lot of talk about telehealth in my little corner of the world 2-3 years ago, and there's been kind of a slow slope downward, at least from a legal and policy world, because to me, it kind of, I don't know if this is the case from a provider perspective, but it feels like there were some good things about that. And maybe we can learn from those and pull them into the future and make, you know, your practice reach more people. But there were a lot of problems with it too. And I think that part of the equation has been hard to imagine how to get through that to make it into a system that we think patients will thrive with. It seems more of like a gap filler, at least, like I said, in my corner of the world. So it's hard to know exactly where it's going. And of course, like you mentioned, fraud and abuse, which of course is used everywhere. You see a lot of investigations now on the telehealth front. Of course, it's hard to know exactly where they go, if they settle, that kind of thing. But those have definitely been on the upswing as well.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting. I know there was an extension up until the end of March for telehealth billing. And we're kind of watching that anxiously, I guess, because there has been a huge benefit to some of our patients. We have a very large behavioral health component of our FQHC, and that's someplace that I think there's some real great testimonials about the impact that you can make with telehealth in some of the more physically related areas where family medicine and obviously dental and vision and some of those things, it has not had the same level of impact. And I think it would have less impact if the rules changed. But in some of these areas, it's become a real convenience for people.
Absolutely. Definitely behavioral health, like you mentioned, for sure.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. We're kind of running out of time. I'm trying to sort through the last 20 questions that I wanted to ask you, realizing that we're not going to get through all those. But I wonder if maybe one of the things we've been seeing rise as well, and this kind of gets back to what we talked about, sort of a nationalized health service. We're seeing this transition from fee-for-service to value-based care. And I would like to get your perspective on the legal and regulatory implications of these models, these value-based care models, and how these models are changing the way that we're being reimbursed. I've often thought if you let physicians bill fee-for-service and they're not good stewards of what they do and they just do things in order to maximize reimbursement, what's the risk of all of a sudden switching to a value-based model where there's an incentive for the physicians to do less to maximize their reimbursement? So I'd like to get your take on that, both from legal perspectives like fraud and abuse, but also some of the regulatory implications. And I'm sorry for the long question there.
No, you're no more long-winded than I am. That's for sure. Sorry I've taken so long. We didn't get to many of our questions, but problem of a law professor. So yeah, I think that the move from fee-for-service to value-based has been a really good move in a lot of spaces. It's also been detrimental in others. I think that every physician I talk to has a story about value-based, whether it's working or not. We know that the big players are benefiting on value-based. If you're part of an ACO and it's well-run and well-maintained and there's good data collection and you're doing really well, you love the new system, the new MACRA plus 9% potentially under new reimbursement for Medicare Part B. So that's one side of the coin. And the other side is if you're a rural provider or you're a sole practitioner in a small town and you don't have the resources to submit the data in the way that CMS wants you to, you're going to be on the short end of the stick. And that's going to probably cause you to think about joining a big system that can do it well. And we've seen that happen. And to the extent that creates monopoly power and saturation, it's not a great thing for patients who don't have a lot of choice already in the healthcare marketplace. So it's interesting. A lot of these regulatory interventions are focused on one problem and they create other issues that you didn't really think that would happen, right? If there's a concern about duplication and you're pushing institutions to work together in an accountable care organization or through a value-based model or bundled payments, you're driving them together. And maybe former competitors are now working together collaboratively, and that might be great for patients. They may be able to achieve what they're trying to achieve with patient-centered medical homes. You go to one spot and you've got all your specialists. But guess what? Those former competitors are now aligned and they have market power in different regions and they can name their price. And you end up with a system that actually prices go up, quality might go up. So again, you're thinking about the cost matrix versus the quality matrix versus access. And so that's all kind of preamble to what you asked. But I do think it's important to recognize that. In terms of fraud and abuse, I do think that the incentives in a value-based model are better, I think, than a fee-for-service model. You know, if, like you said, you're paid more to do more, you're going to do more. If you're paid more to do less, you might do less, but you also have to worry about medical malpractice liability, right? So you don't want to skimp on care to the point that you're not providing enough care to the patients who need it. And so in some ways, what we're trying to do, I think, in the regulatory space is figure out situations in which we have arrows pointing in both directions, and then hope that we can depend upon the heroic goodness of the American provider to strike the right balance. I think that happens over and over and over again. And, you know, it's a really hard place to be in if you're a physician, I think. Now, is it better than the fee-for-service world? Yes, I think it's probably better. I mean, the idea that I tell my law students that, you know, a public payer would not consider quality at all when paying for a service, right, that you pay per Band-Aid or you pay per surgery, whether it's successful or not, is kind of ludicrous, right? But you don't want to make the system too hot where you're not, you know, rewarding everyone in a fair way. And so I think it's something, I think it, I guess, in short, it's a good effort. It's worth spending time on. It's worth expanding and making better. But I think we have to be real about other consequences that could follow related to price impacts and the like, and access impacts as well. If that provider is not comfortable in the macro world where they have to put in all the data and have the adopt electronic health records and get the surveys from all their patients, if they don't feel comfortable in that world, they might close up shop, and then that town loses its physician. And so there's impacts on access too.
Right.
Right. So you think about all these other things as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Well, unfortunately, we're kind of running out of time. I think we've got a whole nother show here that we could do. I kind of left a few sections completely untouched, so that if you ever have the opportunity to come back, I'd love to pick your brain on another couple of major areas. This was really enjoyable. Thank you for taking your time out to appear on Pemba On Demand. It's very much appreciated, Zach.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's great.
It's been great. I hope you enjoyed the Pemba On Demand episode today with Zach Buck. Thank you very much for joining us. Please join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. My guest will be Dr. Archie Bella. Dr. Bella was my guest on the Pemba On Demand live stream earlier this week, March 18th. We will be releasing the show as a podcast in 2 weeks. Archie is the CEO of Opsum Health, an FQHC located just south of San Diego. We are looking forward to having you benefit from the content that he will share with us in this upcoming podcast. Pemba On Demand is released biweekly, every other Thursday, and is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button or follow button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends and colleagues that would benefit from its content. Don't forget that you can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOnDemand. Please hit the like button and subscribe. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website in the show notes. You can also visit our website at tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, where you will find other links to these episodes. Please check the show notes for the links that were discussed in the show. Take good care of yourselves and become a bigger force for good in healthcare. Pemba On Demand is released biweekly, every other Thursday, and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-Demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.